Okay, we're ready to begin. Okay, my turn now. I want to welcome you all back after what I hope was a very pleasant Thanksgiving. As you are aware, Ed Kraus has been filming these sessions that we've had, and I want to thank him so much for all of his work. What I really appreciate, thank you all. What I really appreciate is the fact that as I'm sitting here and you're sitting there, that I have knowledge of people all over the country and all over the world who are listening in and watching us, especially in Israel. I have family and friends who watch carefully. So, welcome to our weekly program. Now, last time we met, 2 weeks ago, after our session, I got a call from Israel, from my son Shaul. My favorite critic. And he said, "Dad, it's an interesting session that you had, but you made a big mistake." So I said, deferentially, because I admire him as a longtime professor of Judaic studies, I said, "What was the mistake?" He said, "When you came to the question period, you had two questions asked of you. You answered both questions in the same way and in the wrong way." So I scratched my head. What did I say and what was wrong? He said, "To both questions you said, that question is irrelevant." "And Dad, there is no such thing as an irrelevant question. A question is asked because somebody wants an answer. Now, you gave the answer, but you started by saying it's irrelevant, and that's insulting."
"I forgive you."
"One second. Before you forgive me, I've got to ask for forgiveness." So that's what I'm doing now. It was improper of me to answer that way. I did it, I think, because it was, I felt in a big rush or something. But no question is irrelevant. But the reason I'm telling you this is that I would love if any of you would call me up after class sometimes and criticize it. Whatever you want to say, it would be very helpful to me to hear that. So, thank you for your very quick acceptance of my apology, Mary. Okay. Now I want to get down to business today. I want to pick up where we left off 2 weeks ago. We talked about the long period of time that the Israelites were slaves in the land of Egypt. But that finally came to an end under the leadership of Moses, the 10 plagues that led Pharaoh to, in the middle of the night, announce to the Israelites that they could leave. And they hastily left, which, you know, gave impetus to the baking of matzahs because they didn't have time to prepare regular bread. They left on their way to the land of Israel with great enthusiasm. Not only a matter of leaving their slavery in Egypt, but looking forward to a new life in the Promised Land. Everybody here, for example, has moved from one house to another, or you've moved from one city to another, and the anticipation of moving is very exciting. It's thrilling. What's going to await us? What wonderful things will happen? There was talk about a land flowing with milk and honey. But as soon as they left, Pharaoh had a change of heart and regretted the fact that he had, for no good reason, actually, there were 10 good reasons, but why did he give up all these people and give up their work as slaves for nothing in return? So he pursued after the Israelites. He sent his army to bring them back. And they were basically defenseless. Then they came to the Red Sea, or the Reed Sea, Yam Suf, that separated them from the Promised Land. And then the Bible vividly describes the situation in which they regarded themselves, reflected in the phrase that we use, the devil in the deep blue sea. Only this was the deep Red Sea. They could not resist the Egyptian military force. And on the other hand, they could not walk through the Red Sea to escape. So what did they do? They did what Jews always did. They prayed. After all, they had experienced and gone through these 10 miracles that eventually led to their freedom. So, God, one more miracle, okay? God's response, as we read in the Bible, was this: go forward, Israel, and I will enable you to cross the sea on dry land. What I want to emphasize is the sequence of what God said. He did not say, I will part the waters and you will go on dry land, so go forward. He said what I just read from the book. The Midrash, which was the biblical commentary on the Bible, examined this phenomenon, these words, by saying, God meant that literally. First you go forward, and then the miracle will happen. Now, that doesn't seem to be so profound. What's the difference? But I want to point out that in very large measure, the whole Zionist movement was based on what I just pointed out. Flash forward thousands of years. The Zionist movement began with Theodor Herzl. After 2,000 years of exile, Theodor Herzl conceived of the notion of a return to the land of Israel. In this way, Theodor Herzl was bent on receiving international approval. International approval for a Jewish home in the land of Israel. And how was that going to be obtained in his view? By going to the nations of the world that are powerful and winning their support for this idea. It was a crazy idea. No one had ever before thought of doing that. He actually made a point of going to the heads of government in Europe, because Europe at that time was housed the dominant powers of the world. To persuade them of this concept. And he also, of course, turned to the Jewish people. He had to persuade them. Basically, the Jewish world was not persuaded by Theodor Herzl. The Jewish world was divided into two elements. The traditional element and the non-traditional element that had recently developed, particularly in Central Europe, with the acceptance of Jewish people into society. That was the period when and nationalism began to replace feudalism in Europe. So there were many Jews, particularly Jews of great influence, in Central Europe, in Germany, France, who said, "We don't want to go back to the land of Israel." At one time, yes, we would. But now, we want to be Frenchmen. We want to be Germans. And I might add, the same attitude would have prevailed here in America. We want to be Americans. Not very many American Jews wanted to leave America to go to the land of Palestine. We had everything we wanted here. And we have rights. We're no longer what we were in the Middle Ages. So thank you, Mr. Herzl. We're not interested. The other section of world Jewry was the Orthodox element of world Jewry. And basically they said to Theodor Herzl, "You don't understand. All of this, everything, is in God's hands. It's not in the hands of the nations of Europe. When God decides it's time to bring the Jewish people back to the land of Israel, God will do so. What you are advocating is giving up a faith in God." So, if you don't have one kind of Jew on your side and another kind of Jew on your side, how can you proceed? You're going to persuade European powers when you can't even persuade the Jews to want to do this. The answer came, and we really, I don't think, have given adequate attention to this. But the answer came from Orthodox rabbis in Europe who sided with Herzl. They came to be known as proto-Zionists. Two of them were the most prominent. One was a rabbi, Zvi Hirsch Kalischer, who was trained in Posen, in Prussia, in Europe. And the other was a rabbi, Alkali, from today's Serbia, used to be Yugoslavia. Well, it so happens that when I was a student at the Jewish Theological Seminary, I wrote my senior thesis on Rabbi Kalischer. So I got to know him pretty well. The central notion of Rabbi Kalischer was, look at the Bible. The Bible said, when they came to the Red Sea, God said, "Go forward, and I will perform the miracle." The Midrash, amplifying these words, said, there was one Israelite who took God's word seriously. His name was Nachshon ben Aminadav. Nachshon. That's one of the names that I want to really talk about today, at least at the beginning. Nachshon. What he did was to turn to the Jews. He, not Moses, and he said, let's go forward. I'm going. Follow me. And he walked into the Red Sea. And the Midrash said he walked until it reached his neck and kept on walking. And people followed him. Then the miracle happened that the waters parted. So, what Rabbi Kalischer said, this is exactly what God wants us to do today. Go to Israel. It may be in Turkish hands. It may be very difficult. We may be very unwelcome. But let's go. Eventually, a miracle will happen, and we will have a home in Israel. That opened the door to the large Orthodox world of the time of Theodor Herzl. And the rest is history. So, the story in the Bible about the Red Sea and Nachshon has such an impact as to result in the kind of world that we live in today with the state of Israel, of which we are so proud today. One more Nachshon story. After so many years, finally the state of Israel came into being. I'm not going to go into any details on that. That's one course after another. The state of Israel was declared by David Ben-Gurion to be a state where?
Africa.
What?
Africa. Africa?
I can't hear you.
Africa.
Huh?
Africa.
No.
Where did
David Ben-Gurion proclaim the state of Israel?
Tel Aviv.
I mean, Tel Aviv is a nice place, and the beach is very nice in Tel Aviv. But if he's proclaiming a state of Israel, why didn't he go to Israel to do it? I mean, to Jerusalem to do it. What? He couldn't get to Jerusalem. The road to Jerusalem was blocked by Arab forces. And that's a story you all have to know, of course. But from the very beginning, he knew, and everybody there knew, that Jerusalem was going to be the capital. And the fact that most of the Jews in Israel were cut off from Jerusalem didn't stop that perception. So almost the first thing in the minds of David Ben-Gurion and the leaders of the new state of Israel was to open the road to Jerusalem. The military operation to open the road to Jerusalem was called Nachshon. The same man who walked into the Red Sea. Operation Nachshon. In Operation Nachshon, they cleared the road. It took a long time. While they were clearing the road, it's like the man who wears a belt and suspenders. While they were clearing the road, they were also building the Burma Road, going around the road to Jerusalem to get to the same place, but not quite as easily and readily. And of course, and both succeeded. And Jerusalem was opened up. And the latest development, and it's going on right now, is the building of the high-speed railroad line between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. So Nachshon played a very important role and too often totally overlooked, stemming from the story of the Red Sea. Okay, now looking back, they crossed the Red Sea and I just want to add the typically Jewish note about crossing the Red Sea. This I think we're all familiar with, but it's good to be reminded of it. This was an enormous, important event in winning their freedom. They just get out of Egypt, and you can imagine the state of mind of people who had been slaves for 400 years, going to a new land to start a new life, managing to cross the Red Sea in the way that they did. And part of it was that the Egyptian army pursued them into the Red Sea, which then the waters collapsed on the Egyptian army. And they won their freedom. What's Jewish about that story is this. It's not just a celebration. Winning freedom is wonderful, but all freedoms are won at a cost. This freedom was won at a cost. And what was the cost? The Egyptian army. One would think that a normal people would say, so what? That's a cost that we are very glad to pay. Anybody would be happy when your enemy has to pay a cost. We don't feel sorry for him. But to this day, at the Passover Seder, we take out a drop of blood from the cup of wine for every plague that befell Egypt, mourning the fact that what was very good for us was paid for by a terrible price by our enemies. That's Jewish. Well, they crossed. And they began a period of 40 years in the Sinai Desert. Very tough years. Nevertheless, the luckiest thing in the world was the fact that they were caught for 40 years in this trap between Egypt and Palestine. Why do I say they were so lucky? Why couldn't have it been much better if they had avoided Sinai and simply gone along the coast? It wouldn't have taken them not 40 years, not 1 year, not even a half a year. So why were they lucky to be stuck in the Sinai Desert for 40 years? Some of you have been in the Sinai. It's miserable there. So why were they lucky? I want you to think along with me. Yep, Roz?
Slaves wouldn't particularly be good at setting up a new, if their whole lives had been slavery, how could they be good at setting up independence and a new flourishing state?
Okay. Well, let me be a little bit more precise about the 40 years. For 40 years, they were out of touch with anybody. No cell phones, no television, totally out of touch. That was the luckiest thing that happened to them. If they had gone directly from Egypt to Canaan, from one civilization, a polytheistic civilization, to another such civilization, they would never have emerged as a Jewish people. They needed 40 years of loneliness to solve their problems. They had enormous psychological problems to deal with, emotional problems to deal with. You can think about this in a very personal way. There are times when we as individuals just have to get away. We have to think through what's facing us in order to deal with it. And that was very difficult for the Jewish people to go out of Egypt and come to the land of Canaan. To illustrate how difficult it was, you read the story in the Bible, the book of Exodus. As soon as they crossed the Red Sea, as soon as they entered into Sinai, immediately they started complaining to Moses in rather harsh terms. What they said was, "Aren't there enough graves in Egypt that you had to take us out here for graves in some strange land? What kind of a place are you bringing us to? Nothing to eat, nothing to drink, no comforts. We were much better off as slaves in Egypt." It didn't take them long to have these feelings, which they harbored for a long time. Anybody who's had the experience of leading a group knows what it means to hear the complaints. I've really been very lucky, but I remember many tours I took to Israel. As beautiful as Israel is, it's amazing how many complaints can be made about going there. I'll never forget, years ago when I first came to Portland, I was accorded the privilege of being a guest member of Tualatin Country Club. Very nice of me. There's a new rabbi in town, so they extended a membership to me. Well, first time I went out there, I didn't know which end of the golf club to hold. But they showed me. So I started playing golf there. I never accomplished anything, really. But I enjoyed it. And I enjoyed meeting some of the people there that, believe me, I never would have met here in the synagogue. And one of them came up to me one day, and he said, "Rabbi, guess what I did last week?" I said, "I don't know. What?" He said, "I went to Israel." I said, "Really? No kidding. You went to Israel?" He said, "Yes." I said, "How did you like it?" "It's terrible." I said, "Really? What's so terrible about it?" He said, "I was in Israel for a whole week. I couldn't find anybody to make a good Bloody Mary." Nowhere. Terrible. Well, that's the kind of Jew that went with Moses into the Sinai Desert. Believe me, there weren't any Bloody Marys in Sinai. So they needed those 40 years. They needed them to work out a lot of problems, and I just want to indicate some of them to you. One of them I've already pointed out. Physical conditions. Food, and at least for my story, drink also, really determines how much you enjoy a trip. You ask anybody when they travel, "How is the food?" That's very important to people. And they had heard about milk and honey, but they didn't hear about tumbleweeds and desert sand. So we do the same sort of thing here. How many of us here like to camp? camp out. There's got to be a lot of names here, a lot of hands, because a lot of people in the Northwest love camping out. But camping out requires patience, dealing with reality, with problems, with difficulty, adjusting. It's not like checking into a 4-star hotel. Depends what kind of a vacation you want. So that was the first big problem that the Israelites had of adjusting to a difficult life. Now, slavery is difficult, but slavery has its advantages. Because the owner of slaves has to provide a place to sleep, has to provide food, has to provide minimum requirements if you're going to be a good slave. Here, you're totally on your own. What did they have to eat? In the desert. Manna. What's manna? We're not sure what manna is. Most of the speculations are that manna are extrusions from plants. Whatever it is, they have to live off the land. They probably took provisions with them from Egypt. But 40 years? They didn't have freezers. So they faced real physical difficulties. The only thing I want to compare it to, if you've never read the account of Golda Meir, when she first came to work in a kibbutz in Israel, how terribly hard it was. And just think about it a minute. The kibbutzim came to literally a land of rocks and lack of water resources, and life was extremely difficult in a kibbutz. You not only had to work during the day, but you had to stand guard at night. The early pioneers in Israel had a terribly difficult time of it, in the same way that they did in these 40 years. But you stick it out, and eventually you will. Let me tell you that life in a kibbutz today is not bad at all. So that's one problem. The other problem that they had was that this notion of monotheism was still a foreign notion. They had been raised for so many generations in a land of idolatry, of many gods. Your whole life changes when you encounter and become involved in a monotheistic faith. Just imagine to yourself, again, we all know that the greatest moment of those 40 years, the greatest moment was the revelation at Mount Sinai. What a moment that was. The entire community gathered at the foot of Sinai, hearing God's voice, proclaiming the Ten Commandments. And the response of the Jewish people at that time was, Na'aseh v'nishma. We will do and we will hear. They pledged themselves to obey the law even before hearing the law. That's a high moment of enthusiasm and spirit. Then we also read in the Bible the story of the golden calf. How long after the experience at Mount Sinai did they build the golden calf? 1 or 2 days. What kind of a people is this? 1 minute you're so enthusiastic about God and God's message, and the next day you build a golden calf. I think I once shared with you, I had an experience, something like that, as a rabbi in Portland. This didn't happen in Portland, it happened in Los Angeles. I remember telling a group, I thought it was you, I went to a meeting, the first meeting of the National Rabbinical Assembly in Los Angeles. And at this meeting, they were going to discuss basically whether to have women rabbis. And Rabbi Gershon Cohn, the director, the president of the Jewish Theological Seminary, made an impassioned speech pointing out that in our lifetime, we lost 1/3 of the Jews in the Holocaust. We lost basically all of the Jewish life in Europe. What a terrible loss that was to us. Now we're talking about women who comprise at least 1/2 of the Jewish world. And we're telling that half, you cannot become religious leaders in our community. We are doing this to ourselves. It's not the Nazis telling us, but we are doing this to ourselves, removing 50% of our potential resources of leadership. When he finished his talk, about 500-600 rabbis stood up and cheered. And the very next day, they voted not to have women rabbis. I felt like going through the floor. I'll never forget that occasion. I can really empathize with how Moses felt when he comes down from the mountain and sees the people worshiping a golden calf. What kind of a world is this? So they had problems that they had to work out. They couldn't root out overnight decades of life of idolatry that they had experienced.
Question. Wasn't there also a factor that there was a military force along the coast?
The what?
Let me repeat that. Wasn't there also a factor that there was a military force along the coast that they would have had to overcome than go the long way around?
So they went inland. We don't know exactly the route, but we have a pretty good idea of what the route was. That's true. But what I'm saying is, in those 40 years inland, they had to solve these problems. They had one other problem to solve. My watch stopped, by the way. What? 5 more minutes. One more problem. Leadership problem. Moses was a leader. He had led them already out of Egypt and into Sinai and on the way to Israel. Along comes one of the Israelites named Korach, and he said, why should he be the leader? I'm as smart as he is, smarter. I'm a better leader. And he challenged the leadership of Moses. So that's the famous story of Tohu Korach. So what happened? Eventually, God punished him for doing this by having the earth swallow up Korach and his followers. Well, you know, I thought to myself often, in today's America, a lot of political conflict that's going on. I would imagine there are some people in America, maybe even some Democrats, that would like to see the earth open up. Well, I'm glad you're laughing, but it reflects a problem. Just as we have real problems of leadership, it existed then. Moses had to solidify his leadership and finish the job that he began. So he could only do that in isolation. The means in this case were pretty extreme, but a lot of extremes happen in life. So what I'm pointing out is that the whole section of the Bible, which primarily deals with this transition from slavery to freedom, from Egypt to Canaan, to Palestine, was one that was fraught with enormous internal problems of organization. Once that had been accomplished under Joshua, well, really under Moses, but then completed under Joshua, and that's the last act that Moses performed, which was so important, of making the transition from one leader to the next one smooth and natural, without trauma, without disorder. So when they were able to do all that, they were by that time ready to enter into the land of Israel. So next week we're going to be dealing with what happened when they got to Israel. See how successful they were under the leadership of Joshua and the judges. So, any questions? And I promise that they're going to be relevant. Okay. Oh, Steve.
What chapter?
We're going to be reading through, I know, chapter 9. It's right here. No, we'll read. Please read through chapter 11. Chapter 11. Okay. Thank you very much.